It all got awfully quiet when Josh walked in the door there just then. Appreciate John doing the class for us last week. If you'll have your Bible open to the little one chapter letter of Jude. I guess no chapters, just a little short letter, but so meaningful, a little letter, and one that's so much needed in a world where people are tempted to just assume there is no true or false and no right or wrong. That happens because we've already, I don't know if we start here or we end up assuming that nothing is really real. There's no reality or unreality. And Jude does us the favor of showing, I think, that because there is such a thing as reality, there's also such a thing as that which is false and that which is evil. And he does us the favor of issuing a much needed and relevant wake-up call. Now, we've already mentioned that the heart of this letter is somewhat difficult because it has what would be regarded as a harsh tone. You don't set out just completely decrying a group of people ordinarily in our setting now. It's considered to be impolite to address reality the way Jude does. But Jude writes like this because he cares. Because he cares about the Lord. Because he cares about our common salvation. Because he cares about his brothers and sisters in the Lord. Jude does not write because there is any lack of assurance in his mind. He doesn't write because he is insecure. We've already tried to show that the beginning and the ending of this little letter has some of the most beautiful language in the Bible in it. Jude does not write because he has a feeling of superiority or because there is somehow another prejudice to him. He talks about our common salvation and our having been called to like precious faith. That's not the issue. What is the issue, I want to remind you, is in verse 4. Certain people have crept in, he says, who are ungodly people who pervert the grace of our God into sensuality and deny our only Master and Lord. So if you start at the end of verse 4 and kind of notice the points, the characteristics here, and back up, you notice the general outline of this letter. These are people who refuse to be dictated to by a Lord or Master. They deny him. They deny his right to rule their lives. Secondly, they take the grace of God and turn it into an excuse for immorality. And thirdly, they are people who, because of the first two things I've mentioned, have an ungodly orientation. They are not detached. They don't see life in view of who God is and what God wants. There's no anchor to their life in that way. Now, last week, if you can kind of call to mind verses 5 through 7, if you know, we have Bible classes so that we learn what's happened and God's dealing with people. So we know the stories, and then when we see something happen, we can call the stories to mind and make application. Jude says, I want to remind you of these things. And then he mentions, if you remember, the rebellious, the unbelieving, disobedient people of Israel who fell in the wilderness, murmuring against God's leadership and provision for them. Then he mentions the angels who arrogantly left their proper habitation. And then he mentions Sodom and Gomorrah, who immorally devoted themselves to strange flesh. And then you learn that in all three cases, God exercised judgment of those activities, either the disobedience, the rebellion, or the immorality. God judged it all. And then you see teachers, a group of religionists come through, and they are characterized by arrogant rebellion, immoral conduct, and an unattached or disobedient life or disobedient attitude. What would you, knowing the stories, and here's the stories, here's what happened to them, here are people doing exactly what these did, what would you think? What application would you make? You would think that the same judgment would occur, and therefore, would you follow their teaching? Would you follow their lead? Would you accept their word about things? See, ideally, you would say, aha, I know this is what these people did, and this is how God judged them, and now these people are doing what these people did, therefore, I will not be taken in by them. Only thing is, these people are acting like these people. And some of Jude's readers are in danger of apparently being led astray by them. So that's kind of the way we'll look at this text here tonight. Start with me in verse 8 now. I want to read them in sections if I can. Verses 8 and 9 to start with. And we start with, just for the sake of outlining, just call it the manner of. You can think of the way of or the character of these dreamers, Jude will call them here. Yet in like manner, these people, and I'm just outlining it based on the recurrence of that phrase, these people or these. And it'll be mentioned five times. In like manner, these people also, relying on their dreams, ESV's translated it, relying on their dreams. Some of the versions just say, these dreamers defile the flesh, reject authority, and blaspheme the glorious ones. But when the archangel Michael, contending with the devil, was disputing about the body of Moses, he did not presume to pronounce a blasphemous judgment, but said, the Lord rebuke you. Now, the manner of these dreamers, why do you think he calls them dreamers? ESV translating it, relying on their dreams, suggests one alternative. What would he be saying there? What would he mean by that? All right, they do think highly of themselves. That would be, like we would say, you're dreaming. That part, maybe. What else would you say? Relying on their dreams. Interpret their dreams to be authoritative. Right, They would be unattached to the authority of the Lord's Word. They would claim that their own dreams are somehow, or visions, are the authority, and that they, of course, are the interpreters of their own dreams and make their dreams mean what they want. So they would be thinking, basically, hey, we can do what we want or what we think. That's one possibility. Can you think of another possibility for dreamers? And remember back in verse 4, he says, these ungodly people, and I've mentioned that ungodly means impious, or it means they have no worldview that is oriented around loving God with all heart, soul, mind, and strength. They're not anchored to any reality. So it's possible that is the point that Jude is making. These are people who are, they're not bothered by what's real or what isn't. They just invent a world for themselves. And that'd be a pretty modern approach, wouldn't it? Pretty much what happens. All right, so now what Jude does is to compare these dreamers, these people, with those who have already been judged, and then he will contrast them with Michael the archangel and his dealings with the devil. So first off, those who've been judged already. Like them, these people defile the flesh. What would he mean by that? What would it mean to defile the flesh? All right, to live in an unholy way, to engage in a life dominated by lust. It would mean to teach and practice immorality, to defile their own flesh and to lead other people also to engage in immorality. Secondly, they reject authority. What would that mean? Whose authority? God's authority or anyone in service of God representing authority. It could mean authority of those charged with responsibility in leading the church, overseeing it. It could mean authority of civil rulers whom God has appointed, and ignoring any need to be subject to what anybody says except yourself. So it would be rebelliousness, I think, more likely because of what verse 4 said about denying our only Master and Lord, Jesus Christ. I think it's talking about the Lord's authority, probably especially. Third, blaspheming the glorious ones. What does blaspheme mean? To speak against God. Sometimes the word is translated to slander. Who would be the glorious ones? Because of what's been said in this book in verse 6 about the angels, and then because of what will be said in verse 9 about Michael the archangel, usually the glorious ones are taken to refer to God's messengers, the angels whom he sends to complete his task. I think you could translate it just God's holy ones and include his people in it, and you wouldn't go far wrong either. But to blaspheme anything that's holy. So this would be irreverence. So you have lust, rebelliousness, and irreverence. And you have physically, these people are immoral. Intellectually, these people are arrogant. And spiritually, these people are disobedient. That's a pretty good summary of what Jude is talking about. Now, on the other hand, the ways of these dreamers contrasts, he says, with an episode involving the archangel Michael. This is one of the places where Jude draws on a story that's told in a non-canonical book. That is a writing that was respected and known by the Jewish people of Jude's time, but it was not a part of the Old Testament scriptures. And Jude will make reference to this writing more times. Now, it's not that different from the way Paul sometimes quoted pagan poets whenever he saw a truth that he wanted to use to illustrate a point. And that's sort of, I take it, what Jude is doing here. He sees a truth, and he knows his people know it, and he's talking in language that they could understand, identify with, and communicating in that way. What's an archangel? What is an archangel? The archangel is mentioned in 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 16 in the New Testament. And this particular one, I think Michael, is mentioned in Revelation 12 and verse 7. So what is an archangel? Arch would be chief or lead. You think of it, or primary one. And Michael, the archangel, is mentioned in the book of Daniel in the Old Testament as the particular chief servant or representative in the interests of the people of God. Daniel 12 and verse 1 would be an example. Now, in this episode, it involves the case of what was said to have happened with regard to the body of Moses. Remember where Moses died? See if you've been in Bible class and remember. What was the name of the mountain? Wasn't it Pisgah? Where he died and went up and he got to look out over the promised land, but not to enter it. But it's Nebo. Maybe it's Nebo. And God buried him. But here there is controversy over his body. Michael, the archangel, seems to have been sent to attend to what God wanted done, but he ends up in a dispute about the body of Moses with the devil. Why would the devil have had any claim over the body of Moses? Two reasons. All right. One would be because Moses had sinned at some point. Usually the writers will say, well, it's because he killed a man in Egypt. And therefore the devil was asserting a claim over him in that way. Another possibility is that the devil was acting like he had sway over the whole earth. Remember, like he did in the book of Job? I've been going up and down, to and fro, in the whole earth. You know that idea. So the nature of the opponent that Michael has here is what? How would you describe Michael's opponent? Honorable, someone who is completely upright, respectable. Any of that? He's a liar and a murderer, a cheat, and has no goodwill in him anywhere. Not admirable in any way. And Michael ends up contending with him, but he did not presume to pronounce blasphemous judgment even against Satan. Now, if you're not going to pronounce blasphemous judgment against Satan, who are you going to pronounce it over? Nobody. Why would Michael not pronounce blasphemous judgment over even Satan? Becky? All right, it's not his role. He's leaving place for God. That's part of it. And secondly, is Satan powerful or not? You hear people say, well, Satan has no power except what God allows him to exert. But Satan is influential, isn't he? David? All right, so that's the third part of this. He just simply said, the Lord rebuke you. And this is... the phrase actually appears in the Greek version of the Old Testament in Zechariah 3 and verse 2. The Lord rebuke you. That was enough for Michael. But these people that Jude is worried about, they would have had no such hesitation. They would not have given place to the Lord like this, because in their mind, they've already denied their master and Lord. They've rejected his authority and claimed it for himself. So their behavior completely contrasts with Michael's. It's like the ones that God has already judged, but unlike the servant of God that many of them may have been interested in because of his role as an angel. One writer said, this little section here is a part of Jude's call to awake to moral integrity, intellectual humility, and spiritual sensitivity. And I like that little summary of this part. Moral integrity, intellectual humility, and spiritual sensitivity. That's the nature, that's the manner of these dreamers now. So move to the next couple verses, the nature of these people. And I'm talking about their character. There are two statements in these next two verses that are built around a statement at the start of verse 11. Woe to them. Here's what it says. But these people blaspheme. What do we say blaspheme means? To speak against something which is holy. It means to slander. But these people blaspheme all that they do not understand, and they're destroyed by all that they, like unreasoning animals, understand instinctively. Woe to them, for they walked in the way of Cain and abandoned themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error and perished in Korah's rebellion. Now we'll get to the three Old Testament stories there in just a moment here, but notice that the woe to them applies first to how they think, their thought process, verse 10. They blaspheme all that they do not understand. So the idea is, hey, if you don't understand something, don't try to learn about it. Just ridicule it, mock it, slander it, and think that that's all is required. So much of the time in our modern culture right now, if you really notice, people rarely engage in an actual discussion, trying to argue a point or to reason together about some conclusion. It so quickly descends to name-calling and blaspheming and slandering and ridicule that you can't even hear any kind of search for truth or reality. And this is some of the nature of this here. He says that they understand by instinct like unreasoning animals. And down in verse 19, he's going to mention that they are devoid of the Spirit. And I think this is one symptom of that here. And then, interestingly, Jude says they are destroyed. They are destroyed this way. They are destroyed by all that they, like unreasoning animals, understand instinctively. They don't understand spiritual things. They understand like animals, and the way they understand destroys them, which is something to really think about. These people are destroyed, I think, by God through the things that they practice. And you might read Romans 1, the last half of Romans chapter 1, as a perfect illustration of that point. I ran across a little paragraph in working on a class I thought I'd share with you just here, and I think it's thoughtful and thoughtful enough to be sobering to me. I want to read a little bit of an extended part here, so please try to follow. Bear with me at this. How ironical that when men should claim to be knowledgeable, they should actually be ignorant. When they think themselves superior to the common man, like these teachers apparently did, they should actually be on the same level as animals and be corrupted by the very practices in which they seek liberty and self-expression. Now notice this. Jude is stating a profound truth in linking these two characteristics together, that is, seeking liberty and self-expression this way. If a man is persistently blind to spiritual values, deaf to the call of God, and rates self-determination as the highest good, which I think Western man does, then a time will come when he cannot hear the call he has spurned, but is left to the mercy of the turbulent instincts to which he once turned in search of freedom. And those instincts, given free rein, are merciless. Lust, when indulged, becomes a killer. That's a fair observation. I think that's what Jude is getting at here. Now, not only woe to them in the way they think, but woe to them in the way they walk, he says in verse 11 now. In this one, he uses the illustrations. First, they're walking in the way of, they've taken the way of Cain. What do you know about Cain?
Killed his brother.
Why did he do that?
All right,
envy and jealousy is one point. Can you go a little farther? What was the envy and jealousy over? All right, so it was over the fact that God accepted Abel's sacrifice and not Cain. So when you get right down to it, what was Cain's jealousy over? What was his problem, as we'd say it? All right, maybe popularity, but wasn't it really over whether God had the right to say what he accepted or whether Cain had the right to say what God should accept? Wasn't that really the bottom line of it? God accepted Abel's sacrifice and not Cain's. Cain kills Abel because God accepted Abel's sacrifice. Really, Cain's action is not only jealousy against his brother, but it's rebellion against God. So a lot of people will say that here's a man who has a lack of spirituality in his mind. He's not godly or pious. He doesn't allow reality to revolve around God. What about Balaam? What was Balaam's error? Notice this text says they have abandoned themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error. Balaam, we meet in Numbers 25 and again in Numbers 31, verses 16 and following. What was Balaam's error?
Money to prophesy
against the people. All right. He tried to curse the people, place a curse on God's covenant people. Was not allowed to do that, but still wanted the money. So what did he do? He taught the enemies of Israel how to lead the Israelites into immorality and idolatry. Out of his greed, his ungodly motives, he taught the enemy to lead God's people into false religion and immorality. He was prepared in return for money to teach others that sin doesn't matter and therefore to lead people to sin. And these people, he says, have just abandoned themselves to that same error. So with Cain, it's like walking on a road, and now it's abandoning yourself to error. And then what about Korah? Korah had some buddies whose names were Dathan and Abiram. What about Korah? What do you remember about him? This is from Numbers 16, I believe. Remember what he criticized or rebelled against the leadership of Moses, and why? Do you remember? Remember, you take too much on yourself. Remember that? You, Korah and Dathan and Abiram wanted to claim a role in leadership themselves. They wanted standing. They wanted to have a following. They got a whole bunch of people together to take their side, and they challenged Moses and Aaron. This is what led to Aaron's rod that budded, if you remember. And what happened to Korah and Dathan and Abiram and their company, their 250, what happened to them? That's right. The earth swallowed them up. So we found out who was on the Lord's, who the Lord chose and who the Lord didn't from that situation. And these people that Jude is talking about have, and it's interesting, he says they perished in Korah's rebellion. How could that be? Korah's rebellion happened in the time of Moses, long time before this, but how did these people perish in Korah's rebellion? By adopting the spirit of a man who had already been judged and sealing for themselves the same judgment. That's what Jude is warning against here. So it moves from walking in the way of Cain to abandoning yourself to Balaam's error to perishing now in Korah's rebellion. And the problems are jealousy, greed, and pride, I would say, that you see here. Now that leads to the influence of these people. How can people be making this same mistake and going to the and facing the same judgment and still have influence among God's people? You'd be surprised, wouldn't you? Verses 12 and 13 now. These people are hidden reefs at your love feasts, as they feast with you without fear, shepherds feeding themselves, waterless clouds swept along by winds, fruitless trees in late autumn twice dead uprooted, wild waves of the sea casting up the foam of their own shame, wandering stars for whom the gloom of utter darkness has been reserved forever. Not a very flattering picture there, is it? Jude uses every part of the world of nature that he can to illustrate the dangerous influence of people who are taking approaches that have already been judged by God. And he wants the church to be realistic this way. First, he says these people are hidden reefs in your love feast. Love feast would represent fellowship meals, maybe. These people are like sunken rocks just underneath the surface of the water. Sometimes this same phrase is translated blemishes, which is the later use of the word. But either way, it either expresses danger or defilement, one, in the place where the church in its love feast, its fellowship time is closest. There are influences right under the surface that are shepherds feeding themselves. In other words, they're totally selfish. They have their own interest in mind, nobody else's. And in their brazen, selfish way, they're going to cause somebody to crash or to be ruined. So Jude had already mentioned back up in verse 4, they've crept in unnoticed. And now this image here seems to fit that. Next image, waterless clouds. What do you expect to happen if you live in an arid part of the world? What do you expect to happen from clouds?
Rain.
We've learned to really expect that in the last couple of weeks, haven't we? So rain and needed refreshing rain that replenishes, refreshes, fills with life and all of that. But these people are waterless clouds that are just swept along by the wind. What's his point there? They don't do any good. They leave no blessing. They don't help anyone's salvation at all. That's the idea. And third, they are fruitless trees in late autumn. In other words, at the time of the where there should be fruit, twice dead. The idea that they were dead before, the Lord maybe gave them life, and then they're dead again, like the end of 2 Timothy 2. And uprooted stands for nothing left for them but judgment. Like in Jesus' parable, remember the little the tree that had only leaves, and it got withered by his judgment in that way. Wild waves of the sea casting up foam, the foam of their own shame. In other words, it leaves nothing but an old ugly scum on the shore where they have washed up. One time I went with Rob to the beach along north of Malibu. I always thought, man, that'll be beautiful, wonderful, all that. And I got out there, and it was cold, and old seaweed stuff washed up on the seashore there, and the wind had blow so bad you couldn't hardly stand up. And I thought, this is not what I thought. That is the picture, though, that Jude is leaving here. And maybe Isaiah 57:20, there is no peace, says my God, to the wicked. Maybe that's the idea behind this. And then the wandering stars, for whom the gloom of utter darkness has been reserved forever. Most of the comments that I can find about this uses the image of a falling star, a shooting star. There are some who take it as the planets, which are the movement of the planets were used in navigation, but what if a planet got off of its normal orbit and you were trying to guide yourself by it? What a disaster that would be. Most of the time, though, this is understood to be you're watching the night sky and you see a shooting star. What happens with shooting stars? What do you notice about them?
They fade away.
They go out. And what becomes of them then? It's dark, and there's nothing left to them except this is, it says here, utter darkness has been reserved forever. And I notice here, verse 7 ended with the punishment of eternal fire. Verse 13 ends with this darkness reserved forever. And then we'll notice this come up again in verse 15. Here. So this, here's a summary of this. They are as dangerous as sunken rocks, as selfish as perverted shepherds, as useless as rainless clouds, as dead as barren trees, as dirty as the foaming sea, and as certain of doom as fallen angels, this writer said. You don't want to follow them. And don't let them wreck your faith. That's what he's saying. All right, real quickly, and I'm not going to have time to do this justice. Maybe we should just wait with this next part. And I'm going to have to take a Wednesday night or two into the summer quarter to finish this book. I think it's important, and I'm going to, with the elder's permission, to do that, John. We'll have to reserve part of this. This next one is important because it talks about Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesying about these people. What's that all about? And how are we to understand that prophecy? And then verse 15, especially with its four times using the word all, three times some form of the word ungodly, and one time sinner. And then with its mention of judgment of deeds committed and harsh things spoken, I think that's, we're going to need to think about that a little bit more. Appreciate everybody's being with us. Are all the smiles that John was talking about on the faces of the ones who got out of school, are they also on the faces of the parents? For the most part, maybe so. I hope everybody does have a great summer. We got a lot of things to do together in our work as a congregation, and we hope you'll be praying that the Lord blesses us in that. I appreciated John's prayer for the people in Texas. What an unbelievable evil, a tragedy that would happen with 2 days of school left for a bunch of fourth grade kids. Isn't that something? Josh, would you mind to stand where you are and just lead us in prayer to close our class? Okay.
Dear God, we thank you for letting us come together tonight to study your word. Thank you for the encouragement, also the warnings that you bring us. I pray for the families that you decide to lead this congregation, protection and wherever they may be. Please guide and direct your people to help them, to comfort them, to show them the love that you offer all mankind.
Amen. Thank you, guys.